Welcome to the Agile Wire, where professional Scrum trainers Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky discuss Agile topics. Now, here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky.
And we are recording. All right, Mr. Bubbles, kick us off, man.
All right, so this week we've got the Liberators. We're doing a joint podcast with the Agile Wire and the Liberators Network. So, Barry and Christian, what should our Agile Wire listeners know about the two of you before we get started? I'll kick the intro right back to you.
That's great. Barry, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Maybe one very important fact that happened over the year. Already got some questions about it. My avatar is not correct anymore because my avatar is like, I've got this very short hair and now it's not that long like Chris's hair, but it changed. So that's one of the things that people really need to know about me, that if they really focus on my avatar, they might not recognize me in real life anymore. Is that what you're looking for?
Are you guys still in lockdown right now?
Not anymore. No. Okay. It's actually improving quickly in the Netherlands. And actually, next week, Chris and I have our first public class again. And that's going to be the first class in more than a year. So it's going to be quite exciting.
That's awesome. Sorry, I interrupted the introduction.
No, that's fine. Well, yeah, I'm not sure what else to say. Maybe Chris, you can already take it over.
Yeah, well, we're both from the Liberators, both Scrum Masters, and we've always worked with Scrum. And I think Barry and I are both very excited about helping Scrum teams. And, well, basically everything we do with the Liberators has to do with this in one form or another. Just give practical help and also create a community where people can work together. And just to add to Barry, my hair is also like insanely large, but I'll get a haircut next week when it's all okay again. So just don't watch the episode. So but I think that's a short introduction, and I think we can talk about the rest during the podcast.
Sure,
sounds great. And then for your listeners that don't know Jeff and I, I'll give a little background. So Jeff and I used to work together at a consultancy. Basically, we were like cross-functional teams, and Jeff would often be the product owner and I would be the scrum master, and we would come into organizations and help them build the product. And then we would walk away and they would be like, wow, that was really cool. Like, you delivered every single sprint, you get things done. Like, we actually solved customer problems. And then we ended up doing that for a while. People like, can you now teach us how to do that in our organizations? And so we started doing that, and one thing led to another. And, we worked at a couple different organizations together, and now Jeff's off doing his thing, working for a startup that's about to go public. And then I'm running my own company, doing coaching, advising, things like that. Cool. I'm a professional Scrum trainer, just like all of us actually are professional Scrum trainers.
Yep.
Scrum.org.
That's a good addition. Thanks. Yeah.
Cool. So let's jump right in. One of the first topics that we wanted to jump into discussing was the book. So, what is it? Surviving Zombie Scrum?
It's the Zombie Scrum Survival Guide. So that's pretty close. But yeah, it's the Zombie Scrum Survival Guide. And I was just thinking that last summer, we were actually doing the final editing. And it's been out since November last year. But it feels like it was very short time ago that we were still working on the book. And now it's already there for almost a year. That's pretty cool. Yeah, but I think it's something that connects all four of us. We wanted to write the book because we basically want to help Scrum Masters. And mm-hmm. Barry, what's been important for you about writing it?
For me personally, it's all about writing a book that's very practical. And I think around a year earlier, our friends also from Scrum.org, Ryan and Todd, Ryan Ripley, Todd Miller, also wrote a book, Fixing Your Scrum. On top of my mind, I think that's the title. And that one was also very practical. And I think while writing this book, we had a sort of like the same intention, not only write a book with only the Scrum theory, but also include tons of experiments that people that recognize what's going on in their organization, maybe they recognize some of the symptoms that we describe about Zombie Scrum, or they recognize some of the causes of Zombie Scrum and want to prevent further infection on Zombie Scrum, that we really give them something tangible that they can immediately use. And actually, it would be even better. Some of the readers also shared it with us that they found it quite difficult to finish the book because each time they read an experiment, they just wanted to try it. So they put away the book, started the experiment, and then afterwards, continued their reading. I think that's something that I personally wanted to achieve. And based on the feedback, I think we've done a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I really appreciated that about the book where it's like, oh, it's not just here's the problem and you should fix it this way and like a high level theoretical way of doing it. It's like, no, here's some practical things. Like here's an activity you could run. This is how you can make the hidden visible. Here's the first step to solving that problem. Yeah. And then you can take it from there. So I appreciate that because I don't know that there's enough of those books out there for people, right? There's a lot of books about why to do certain things and like how it should be, but not how to get there.
Yep.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that because I think that one thing I just wanted to mention, by the way, that Johannes Schartau is also an author. So it's Barry, me, and Johannes. And one of the things we really wanted to do was really give help. I mean, if you look on LinkedIn or Medium or you follow all the things, all the blog posts that are being written in the Agile community, there's a lot of useful stuff there, but it's not always very practical. So sometimes it's more like Scrum teams should work with sprint goals, end of sentence. Scrum teams should work with stakeholders, end of sentence. And then that's sort of the core message of a blog post or podcast, but then how do you actually do that? And Barry, Johannes, and I dug really deep into our own experience. How have we done this with our own Scrum teams? And how can we translate that into things that other teams can do? So the book actually has like 40 recipes that you can just try with your team. And it also explains why a lot of organizations struggle so much with Scrum. And I think that that combination worked out well in the book.
Mm. The other thing you see a lot is sometimes you just get the practices or the recipes without understanding the why.
Yeah.
You guys connected both of those together really well.
And I like that you use the term recipe. Because, yeah, we offer a lot of tasteful ingredients. But, yeah, it's not a guarantee that it's going to be that the results is going to be tasteful as well. But
I was going to ask, how do you walk that line between being overly prescriptive with solutions when you're talking about problems and trying to remind people not to fall into the trap of the one true way of doing anything versus, you know, the whole gray between that exists between the black and white nature?
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a good one, actually. I don't think we actually offer solutions in the book. It's more like guidance. Like if you try this experiment, this might be the outcome. Probably if you're facing this impediment and you do this experiment, then probably. But the least that you will do is you create transparency around what's going on. What you'll also do with the experiment is we'll help you inspect the results together. But the adaptation part, well, that's really up to you. And based from our own experience, we can give examples of what we saw happening in our own team, in our own organization. But yeah, every organization is different. Every team is different. So we cannot give you silver bullets on if you do this experiment, for sure, this will resolve your impediment. It's more like chances are that it will be resolved. But if not, let us know. And maybe we need to tweak the experiment for your own context.
Yeah, and I think what always helps is, and I think we do this in the book quite well, is that we always try to explain why you're doing it. Like, okay, this is an experiment or a recipe to try, but this is why you're doing it. So we spent one part of the chapter to explain why it's important to involve stakeholders. And then we give people like 10 or 12 recipes to actually involve their stakeholders with the work that they're doing. And I think that that connection, like, why are we doing it, is something that's so important if you work with Scrum teams or basically if you do any kind of work in organizations. That's also a pitfall, right? Many people start with Scrum, don't really understand why you're using it or why they use certain practices. And then it just ends up in zombie Scrum. So start with the purpose.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about that a few times now, but for anybody who may not already be familiar with it, what is zombie Scrum? And do I just put a bullet in the head like a normal zombie, or is there something special I have to do?
No. That's we emphasize in the book like a zombie Scrum is like the name we give to the concept, and we don't talk about Scrum zombies because the people themselves are not to blame for it. So But in a nutshell, Zombie Scrum is something that looks like Scrum from a distance. So you have the roles, you have the artifacts, you have the Scrum events. There's a sprint review happening. There is a product owner. There's a Scrum Master. But at the end of the road, there's no working software. There is no collaboration with stakeholders. Teams don't have autonomy to do anything pretty much. And nobody seems to be bothered to improve anything about it. That's sort of in a nutshell what Zombie Scrum is.
I always like the addition that it lacks the beating heart of working software. Then you have to connect with a zombie again.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like how you guys made it fun in the book and you used all the correlations back to, like, you know, the zombie books and movies that have gone out over the last few years and you know, tied it back to, like, what we do every day was we're building product. And so that was a fun way to read a book that draws those correlations.
You know, what's interesting about the metaphor is that of course, the zombie theme is pretty prevalent on the cover and in the book itself. Mm-hmm. But when we started writing the draft, COVID hadn't happened yet, of course. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden we were like planning the release and then we had a global pandemic and we were like, should we still go ahead with this theme or is this too sensitive right now? And so we toned it down in some areas. And there was also a lot of humor in the book that Barry, Johannes, and I put in there, but no one seemed to get the jokes except for us. So that was the consistent criticism that our reviewers gave. Was like, I don't get this joke. I don't get this sentence.
Guess it's some people had expected just a fun and lighthearted book. And they told us, like, they were in a way disappointed because it was quite serious. It was for them quite painful to read the book, the stuff that they recognized. And but I'll take that as a compliment as well. Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes, like, I'm sure you all feel this too. Like when I run a class or work with organizations to facilitate something, I feel like I learn more than everyone else. Like there's meta level learnings that I learn. And so I'm assuming there's some meta level learnings you learned as doing this book where it's like, wow, we really discovered something by going through this process. Like what was your greatest learning, would you say, when writing the book?
I would say maybe also, I think that's the biggest advantage of having three authors because I've learned so much from Christian and from Johannes. And if I would have written this book alone, well, probably the book wouldn't have been there at all. It would have been much shorter. But many of the concepts there in the book were also, well, maybe not completely unknown, but just I've just heard of them, but I've learned so much of them just while writing the book together. Just one example, of course, I should give an example right now. Maybe the whole example of double loop learning, like single loop learning and double loop learning. Mm-hmm. Not sure how to pronounce his name. Chris, help me out. Christopher Agris?
Argyris. Yeah, I think it's Argyris, but I'd say that I don't know for sure either.
Yeah, but that whole concept about single and double loop learning, that was, well, quite insightful for me as well.
Yeah,
I just want to say, like, is this the moment where I need to explain it ad hoc while not having prepared it? Is that
yes, please.
Sure, yeah, that'd be great.
Well, for me, an example of single loop learning is that you try to find the solution within your existing system. It's just low level learning. It's not like really wrong, but probably the solutions that really matter to the deeply ingrained impediments that you will not find them there. Double loop learning, the way I understand it at least, is where you are going to challenge existing beliefs, existing rules, existing behaviors. Basically the existing system of an organization. And the problem is that if you work in a team or in an organization, then you are part of that system. And so oftentimes you're not even aware of the fact that you are stuck in single loop learning. You really need to take a step back and, well, challenge all the things that you have been doing, every day right now. And just maybe a very simple example could be sometimes teams are stuck so much in trying to find a solution to make Scrum work for them. But maybe Scrum isn't the best framework for helping them find the solutions. Maybe they should try something completely different. Try Kanban or try something else. Maybe that's just, but that's my take on single and double loop learning. And yeah, found it quite insightful for me.
Yes, it's quite a profound idea, actually, because like everyone learns, of course, but the depth at which you learn has a big impact impact on how effective you can learn. And I think that double loop learning is really all about, and you also have triple loop learning, and there are different names out there as well. But the whole point is that it's important to also learn how to learn, to reflect on how are we actually improving things, and are our strategies for improving things actually helpful? So for example, if a development team is automating their tests, but they then spend a lot of time constantly changing those tests, maybe they have to think about, are we testing our work in the right way, or are there actually more intelligent, more effective ways of testing? And what's very hilarious, and I think that this applies maybe to, at least to Barry and me, I can't speak for you, but Chris Argyris in his research also says that consultants and trainers are the worst at double loop learning, because they've usually become successful because of the skills they have, and that sometimes makes them blind to actually engage in double loop learning. So I think that that's always very interesting. And I think Barry and I have some of that. And I can't speak for others, but I think it's an interesting point. It's difficult to do double loop learn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like the question, actually, Chris, that we got asked. Is there anything for you, Chris, that you've learned while writing the book?
Well, something? Germans have a great sense of humor. That's what I learned. So Johannes is our third author. He is the funniest guy we know. And unfortunately, a lot of the humor had to be removed because, well, maybe it's German humor and people don't get that. But I thought it was very funny. And I just can add to what Barry said. If you write a book, you have to write it in a way that you explain it to other people. And I think that that process alone helps you understand what it is you're trying to explain. So I think we've learned a lot about Scrum and to explain it even better. And I think that that's one of the big benefits of writing a book.
Awesome. So how did writing the book lead into the Scrum survey? Because that seems to be the big thing that you're working on right now.
Yeah. Barry, you want to take this one or should I?
No, Eugene. I think you can better explain that one.
Well, the survey was sort of a hobby project that I started a while ago. I think I did it as part of the Liberators, but I already had some things running before that. I've always been interested in ways to help teams with survey-based tools, because I think it's useful to have sort of, when you're making improvements, that you have evidence, that you have data to back up if your improvements are needed and if they're working, if you do it again. So one of the things we've done is, before we started writing the books, we started gathering data with a survey, and that informed some of what we've written in the book, but we're actually doing a lot more research now based on that data that we're gathering. And the cool thing is that you can go to scrumteamsurvey.org and just fill it in. It's a free diagnostic tool. And Scrum teams from all over the world have already done so. I think we have 5,000 teams in there at least at the moment. And that's, I think, very helpful because it gives us a great way to tell Scrum teams, okay, this is what Scrum teams all over the world are doing. This is effective, this is less effective. So try these more effective things. And that's sort of the evidence-based approach that we're trying to explore right now, if we can actually help more Scrum teams that way.
And I can't remember if it was on the site or just some other place that you had published the data out to, but it seemed like it was a pretty diverse set of teams. Like it wasn't just teams in the Netherlands, teams in the US, but pretty diverse across the globe. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, sure. So what's really cool is the Scrum Team Survey is being used all over the world. So we have teams, a lot of teams from Europe. We have a lot of teams from the United States. We have teams from South America, from a couple from China, actually, which was surprising because that's usually not a place where people are comfortable going to an English platform. So that's cool. We have teams from Japan, from all over the world, basically. And what's good about that is that it allows us to actually see what patterns are there across different cultures and across different organizations, across different team sizes. And if there's anything that Barry and I have always found a bit annoying is if people shout things without giving any kind of support for their opinion. And we're quite good at that. Barry and I are quite good at this, by the way, but in our community, we're quite good at this too. And we're trying to change that. Like, okay, let's try to back it up more. And then it's helpful to have a very diverse group of Scrum teams that you can get data from.
Yeah. And maybe one of the ambitions that I had with the survey is that one of the things that we shout in our classes is that Scrum teams should drive change themselves. It sounds very good. And then people look at you like, wow, that's a very smart trainer. But then they leave the training and then they're like, yeah, but how? Sounded so good, but how am I going to change my environment? How can I influence the organization in such a way that we can use Scrum more effectively? I think with the survey, we give them something very tangible. Not only you can diagnose the state of your team or even broader, like the state of Scrum in your organization, but we also included 50 free do-it-yourself workshops. And all these do-it-yourself workshops basically follow the flow of Scrum as well. And by that, I mean they create transparency about what's going on. They help you inspect together with your team, your stakeholders, or management. And they also put you in a position to do the necessary adaptations. And of course, and that's something that a lot of teams need to get the habit of it, is that you don't do the survey only once, but the trick is do it again to see if the improvements or the adaptations that you've made actually had an impact. And that's where you'll get this engine of empiricism up and running. And that's also a way by we can support what we share in our classes. Try to drive change in your own organizations. And why don't you give this free survey a try to help you get started with it?
How often do you recommend teams take the survey? Because there's quite a few questions on the survey. I mean, there's a short version, but the short version is still kind of long.
There's not really like a fixed answer, but probably once every 3 months, something like that. Could be more often, of course, but I think once every 3 months would be a nice rhythm for teams. Mm-hmm. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, I agree. I don't have a clear-cut answer to that. We are thinking about ways to maybe if people repeat the survey that they can just select the things that they're most interested in. But there are some pitfalls that might happen there because people only measure what they think is important, but they forget the things that are actually important. But I think 3 months is good. Is definitely a good idea. Yeah, just do it a couple of times, see if things are getting better over time.
Do you have any cautions for teams that are going to use the survey? Like, don't use it in this way, use it in this way.
Yeah. So many. Transparency is like, it's our lifeblood when we work with Scrum, but it's also dangerous if you just apply it to any situation without caution. So one of the things that we really don't want people to do is that, for example, the manager of a couple of Scrum teams starts inviting teams without giving any kind of background. Like, this is a tool I found on the internet. Please fill it in, report back to me with your findings, and then I'll make decisions about who stays and who has to go from the teams, right? So something like that is something we really do not want people to do. So we actually warn specifically against that when you start the survey. Mm-hmm. It's really, like Barry already said, it's important for us that it's owned by the Scrum teams themselves. So they start the survey, they get the results. Nobody else gets the results, like including Barry and me. We don't get the named results either. And we don't send it to your manager. But it's always important to first start with a conversation within your team. Like, okay, why is it important to create this kind of transparency? And why is this tool helpful for us? And when everyone agrees, then use it. But if people don't agree, don't use it. Use something else, because psychological safety is very easy to destroy if you just sort of push this through.
Mm. And maybe one more. If teams have the option to also include the perspective of the stakeholders, whenever a team is in doubt, like, should we really involve our stakeholders, use that as a signal to invite them. Because it's easy to ask your stakeholders for their opinion if everything seems to be going really good. But there's really a great opportunity to learn a lot from your stakeholders if you're like in doubt, like, well, things are not really going really that well. Use that as an opportunity to ask your stakeholders as well for their opinion. And again, not to judge the team, but more to create transparency. Like, how can we improve collaboration? How can we work together in a better way and deliver value sooner to the stakeholders?
We have this thing here in the Midwest in the United States called Midwest Nice, where we don't like to tell people to their face like what we really think. And so a lot of times teams will think stakeholders are like super happy. And then you give them a survey like this, and you're like, whoa, like they're not happy at all. But like, we never hear that, even though we meet with them every sprint and we talk about what we're doing. they never express that. So this is a nice tool, I think, to maybe make that hidden visible in a safe way, where people might not be comfortable doing it directly sometimes. Yeah. So I like that.
There's actually an anecdote that's nice. Oh, sorry, Jeff, go ahead.
Just adding on to that, I was actually just kind of curious, making that hidden visible, was when you started collecting the data and were able to see it, was there anything startling in the responses that you were getting or something unexpected from the results that you were seeing?
Yeah, there was. So one thing is that I think Barry, Johannes, and I, because we've all been involved in the creation initially, is it's interesting to see that a lot of the things that you would expect to be much higher are actually much lower in the scores that teams get. For example, product discovery is something that very few Scrum teams engage in if you look at the data. And in a way, it's a gut feeling I already had, but but you would expect that if you use Scrum, then you're using it for product discovery to sort of incrementally discover what the product is. And that's not really happening all that much. We also saw very clearly that I actually thought initially it was a statistical error, but that psychological safety is like an insanely powerful predictor of continuous improvement. So teams where psychological safety is low, there's no improvement happening. But if it's very high, then it's much easier. Actually, all the things in the model in our survey score higher if psychological safety is high. And it's kind of an open door in a way, because everyone talks about that all the time, but it's very nice to actually see this happening so clearly in the data, which I think is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And it's nice because the tool itself, well, I don't know, make things so that you can't tell it's like team A that said this or team B if you're looking at a whole system. And if you see us as a system, a common pattern like no one does discovery, well, that's probably a system problem. That's not a team problem.
Yeah.
And so now that's something we can go and fix, you know, organizationally.
And that's actually something we want to add in the coming period, because right now it's very much focused on Scrum teams, but we also want to make it possible for multiple Scrum teams in one organization to actually see sort of the aggregation of all their scores, so that you can see that as Scrum teams in this organization, we're all not engaging in product discovery. What's going on? Can we do some double loop learning here to see what we can improve, right? So,
what would be really cool, and I'm just looking at Chris right now, like, start building it, man, is that you could also see, like, if a team does a certain intervention, like they've tried an experiment, that you can also see what changed. So they've done an experiment, and based on the experiment, they can see that if they try to survey again, ship it fast, actually improved, but somehow, I don't know, improved continuously, decreased. Something like that, because then you can really, in a empirical way, in a validated way, measure if the things that you try in your organization actually have the impact that you have in mind.
Mm-hmm. Have either of you tried it out, Jeff? What was your experience of using it?
So things I really liked about it, so I've seen a number of homegrown tools that other organizations have built to go through. And oftentimes they focus on, you know, are the teams writing, is their product backlog using user stories? Do they story point every, you know, every product backlog item? Things like that. And it's like, well, that's just a practice. You don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. What are we really after here? Do we think about the customer? Are we delivering incremental pieces of value? Like, if that's really what you want, we should be asking that question. It's a different question. And so I really like the way you frame all the questions up. Like, they're all very behavior driven. They're very focused on a certain content. I feel like there's a very good reason for every single question that you're asking. And so I really appreciate that part about it. And I think that it's a problem that a lot of teams are trying to solve, a lot of organizations are trying to solve. And it's better to have, it's just one of those things, like, if everybody's doing it, I feel like there's a lot of inefficiencies. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a lot of data and scientific way of using or asking these questions that isn't being used because you're just doing the best you can and that's not your primary focus. And so I think that it's a good problem to solve in the world. So I think that I like it, I guess. And I like the workshops, and I like that you're making hit invisible. So it's good. I don't know, Jeff, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I feel like a little ashamed here. It's like my dirty little secret is that I haven't been using Scrum for like the past 8 months. Right? Like,
I'm out
fired, PSP card removed. No, but I haven't had an opportunity to use it, but I was kind of curious, in line with what we were just talking about. Do you have the ability? So if I'm a team, sign up, take the survey, input all my points of data, and then I come back in 3-6 months from today, do it again. And can you track trends over time? Okay, that's awesome. Because Barry, just like you were talking about, like, I would love to be able to see, hey, we ran this experiment hoping to really target this area. That was a few months ago. Like, what were the results of that? Did we actually improve in that area? And I think that can be a really powerful thing, like we were just talking about with that double loop learning. Like, great, like, we want to improve our day-to-day, but we also want to improve the system, right? Like, what are the things that are keeping us from being able to excel in this other area? Mm. It can be very powerful point to inspect.
Yeah, I hope that a lot of teams will use it for that purpose. Just want to mention that right now that is still a subscriber feature. So it's something that you have to actually subscribe for. So the core features are free, but for some of the features, just so we can actually fund the whole development that's happening, is we have some subscriber features. But one thing we would like to do at some point is to make the trend feature available for, say, up to 3 teams or something for free, and then maybe expand it from there. And I just want to connect to something that Bubble said that I think is also quite important for us, at least, is that one of the things that Barry and I are constantly explaining right now is that it's not just a survey, even though we call it the Scrum Team Survey. So maybe the name has to change. But a lot of companies, as you also said, Jeff, are sort of creating their own checklists or their own surveys or. And this is something that we constantly hear from people. Yeah, we have our own Google form that people can fill in.
Our own maturity model. That's even worse.
Maturity model.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. Let's be clear about this. But I have a background in organizational psychology. My first job was actually to work for a company where we developed surveys to diagnose how things were going in organizations. And back then, I was already thinking, like, we can do this way more effectively, because that was still sort of in the early internet era. So we can do that more effectively. And in a sense, that's what the Scrum Team Survey is now. And the survey that we have, the questions that we present, are actually developed in a scientific way. It's not just a bunch of questions that we came up with. We actually iteratively tested out a lot of questions. We kept those that were actually the best ones that distinguish the good teams from the not so good teams. And so there's really a whole model behind that. It's important for people to know. I think it's not just a bunch of questions.
Maybe, yeah. Chris, you can also share a bit about your collaboration with Daniel Russo. Because it ties into the research.
Yeah, sure. So the thing that we're doing right now is it's really cool. I'm also quite tired from the whole process because it's been very, very hard work. But with all the data that we've collected to date with the Scrum Team Survey, we've done a scientific analysis. We've actually written an academic publication about this together with Daniel Russo. He's professor of the University of Aalborg in computer science. And he has a background also in this kind of research. So it was very nice to collaborate with him on actually analyzing the data and writing it out in an academic publication, which is important for us because it's a way to show that we're actually onto something, because that's what we show in the paper, that the model that we have behind the survey actually captures quite a large part of what makes Scrum teams more or less effective. And we can also start giving more evidence-based recommendations based on this, because we now have, we can now back it up basically with science. There are also some things we're unable to back up with science, which I think is also a good sign. So some of the things we expected to find were not there. But is there anything, Barry, that you think I missed?
No, I'm just thinking that it's quite confirming for us, or reassuring for us. Like, we've got 4 Scrum Doc trainers in this call. And for me, it's quite important that the key outcomes of the paper that Christian wrote actually confirm many of the things that we're actually teaching in our classes. So it would have been quite painful if one of the results would have been that the Scrum Doc classes don't make a lot of sense. But luckily, it backs it up, actually.
Is it helpful if I summarize the key findings?
Yeah, what were the top 3 or top whatever findings? That'd be
great. Yeah, because listeners can check out the paper for the details. And science is always about nuance. So if I sort of summarize it, I lose some of the nuance. So please go check out the nuance. the core finding that we have is that we can predict a very large part of Scrum team effectiveness just from five variables. So it's, can teams actually release frequently? That's one variable. Do they work closely with stakeholders? Are they actually able to improve their process continuously, or is there a climate of continuous improvement? Do they have a high degree of autonomy, and how much management support do they have? Mm-hmm. So with these five factors, we can explain, or we can predict almost the effectiveness of a Scrum team. That means that if organizations want to actually support their Scrum teams more effectively, these five things are the things you want to go for. And in the paper, we actually give more background on what is team autonomy, what are the things below team autonomy that you can look for, what are the things below stakeholder collaboration that you can look for. But this is sort of the core model that we present. And what I think was really nice is that we show very clearly in the data that the Scrum teams that are collaborating closely with their stakeholders are by far the most effective, which makes sense, I think, also for us as Scrum practitioners. But if teams do not release frequently, even when they work very closely with their stakeholders, even when they have high autonomy, even when they continuously improve and have a lot of support from management, if they do not release frequently to their stakeholders, none of that matters. So actually, the ability to release frequently is sort of a gatekeeper to the effectiveness of all the other things I just mentioned. If you don't do that, there's no point to this. And in a way, that's what zombie Scrum is, right? There's no beating heart of working software.
And maybe we could just define stakeholders to people, because I think that that's a myth that's out there that a lot everybody's a stakeholder. They all care. And it's like, I like the way that you talk about it often in, you know, on Medium and other articles that you guys publish, where you're like, people that care aren't necessarily stakeholders. Like the director of marketing, they're not really a stakeholder. They have an opinion, but they're really there to help you, you know, accomplish a certain goal with the product. People that are using the product, funding the product, paying for it, they're your stakeholders, right? They have a stake in it. They really care what happens to that product physically.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people have a lot of audience in their sprint review, but audience is not the same as stakeholders. However, audience can make a lot of noise. So it can feel like, wow, we had an awesome sprint review. So much noise. Must have been good. But somehow we did not get the feedback that we were actually looking for, or somehow we were not able to make any decisions that actually matter. If that happens, so you don't get any value out of your sprint reviews, for example, could be because you don't have any stakeholders, the actual stakeholders in your sprint review, but only audience.
I want to back up for just a second. So, Christian, earlier when you were talking through the survey results and those five key attributes, you had used an interesting word in there, effectiveness. Like, how did you define effectiveness? Like, if this is the end state, this is really what we want, here are these five attributes, but what is that end state?
That's such a good question, because on LinkedIn, you can easily talk about effectiveness and not explain what you mean. And everyone's like, yeah, more effective, that's good. But you have, in science, you have to clarify it, right? So that's nice. It's not easy to define it, but what we did in our study is we basically consider two things, like how satisfied are stakeholders with your product, like the actual stakeholders, like Jeff just said, because that's an indicator that many Scrum teams recognize is indicative of their effectiveness. And the second one, which is more internal to the team, is how high is team morale? How satisfied is the team with its own work? So we purposefully picked an external indicator and an internal indicator. And there are other ways you can measure effectiveness too. And maybe we're going to expand it in the future. But I think these two, for our purpose, were very useful. And they're very recognizable for many Scrum teams out there too. Mm-hmm.
So if I could parrot that back to you in my head, like I always try and like, you know, bridge the gaps between what somebody's saying versus what I'm thinking. But delighted customers and delighted employees.
Like, yeah, that's a very good, way better than what I just explained. Yeah, but that's cool. It. That's exactly what it is. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And that's what we measured. We actually asked teams, how satisfied are your stakeholders? How satisfied are you? Data that we're collecting right now is actually from the stakeholders themselves, because that's even more accurate. And we're going to redo the analyses with that data. Good summary.
Maybe Chris, just going to ask you a couple of questions as well, because I always like how you describe the difference gonna put you on the spot right now, but the difference between team happiness and team morale, because a lot of teams are measuring happiness and they have these happiness indicators.
Does anyone here do that actually? How do you measure satisfaction in your team if you do it?
It's be more like a survey. Like sometimes we'll do like a fist of five or something like that, like in a retro, like how are we feeling after this sprint, you know? Or, and then maybe something more formal out of a different cadence, you know, like every month or something, we'll do like a smaller survey or something that they would fill in, and we look for trends,
right,
up or down. One organization we were in, it was actually pretty interesting. Back when we were all physical, they had these tablets, and they're up in front of different parts of the office, and they just had different smiley faces. And as you went by, they encouraged you just to hit, nice, how are you feeling today? And then they would just collect that over periods of time and be like, wow, Whitey, after this all employee meeting, did everybody say they were upset? Well, we definitely said something wrong or something to piss people off. So then like it would lead into like, okay, we have to do something about that, you know? So it was, that was an interesting way of doing it. Another one that I found that, not all teams, but there were some teams that do this where every time they're doing a check-in in GitHub, they would put a rating like inside of the comments of like 1 through 5, 5 being like, this was amazing code to work on. And 1 is like, this sucks.
Ooh, that's nice.
And then like, so it's like, this is happening all the time. And so like, you start to see a lot of 1s and 2s probably going to have a rough release here whenever we go out with that, you know, without that code. So it was definitely a leading indicator of things to come.
I like those examples. Ultimately, it's all about starting a conversation about some of the patterns, right? But I think, Barry, what you mean is you can measure two things, basically. You can measure how happy are people with their work, which is much more a moment. That's a particular moment in time where you're happy or unhappy. I don't know about you, but for me, during a day, it goes like this, right? It changes a lot. So one of the things that I always like to ask, in addition to just happiness, is also like, what's your willingness to be part of this team and to struggle, to basically put your shoulders on it together with us, to, even when it's hard. And that's something we call team morale, and that's more stable over time. So even if people are very unhappy in the moment, they can still have very high morale. And one of the good things about that is that if you look for morale, you're probably not going to see a lot of jerks up and down. It's more stable. However, if it goes down, you're in big trouble. And that's also, it ties well into a lot of research that has been done. Like, if you want to focus just on happiness, it's just going to be like this. So how are you going to determine what to actually do with it? Whereas if you look for a more stable thing like team morale, it's actually more helpful to determine what are actually important changes to make. But I think it's valuable to measure both, ultimately.
Yeah, sure. But I've worked with teams where happiness wasn't always very high. It wasn't low, but not like exceedingly high. But team morale was. And that was also, I think, mainly because those were the teams where we had a very clear product goal and a clear sprint goal. And that sort of like sparked a certain energy, a certain morale within the team, where everyone was like what Christian said, put the shoulders under it and go for it. But that didn't mean that happiness was always like a 5 on the scale of 5, like that, the highest score every day. Sometimes it was quite low, but it didn't mean that morale was low.
I forgot to add one thing to that, by the way. Barry reminds me of this, is that team morale is actually very closely connected to burnout, or at least the early stage of burnout is cynicism. And if people get cynical in a team, that's a bad sign. Some cynicism is okay, because we all have some black humor here and there to deal with stressful moments. But if it's persistent, that's a bad sign. That's actually has a big consequence for mental health also of your team members. So that's why I think something like team morale or something similar is important to measure. We have it in the Scrum Team Survey, but there's also the team morale tool that we created. It's also available for free that you can use with your team for that. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Jeff, I interrupted you.
Just thinking back. It was a while ago. I mean, maybe it was 6 months ago or something like that, when we had Johanna Rothman on, Jeff. I don't know if you remember this. We said something like, you know, team happiness. We got onto that, and she like stopped us right away. It's not like, it's not happiness that you want. And I think she said team satisfaction is really
that's
what you want.
But, a good one.
But she talked about basically team morale is how she described it, the same way that you two just described it. So I think that's a really good point. Like, happiness is going to have those ups and downs. You don't care so much about are you happy, or like, are you willing? Like, it's more that feeling of after you're done, like, do you feel like, man, I did a good job today? Like, you know, whenever you, especially we do so much knowledge work, but I definitely feel this whenever I do something that's more hands work and do something manual, like, well, you look back and you're like, wow, look at all that stuff that I did today. You know, and you feel that satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the moment that you're looking for in your team is like, wow, do I look back at today and be like, yeah, we made an impact today. Mm-hmm. We helped somebody today. Like, and you feel good about that. That's a feeling of satisfaction. That's what you're looking for. That team morale is the same, very similar.
It's actually based on similar research. So it's just a different name. But I think the good thing is, and you mentioned this too, it's like morale and satisfaction are more clearly connected to the purpose. Mm-hmm. Like, are we achieving our purpose? Are we actually working on our purpose? And then you're more satisfied. Happiness can be because of any reason. Like, it's sunny outside, I'm happy. Or mm-hmm. I woke up and I didn't sleep well and I didn't have my coffee yet. And and now I'm not happy like me usually in the morning. So,
but then to tie it back to Zombie Scrum, I think that's what we also see. That team that don't have a clear purpose, that don't have a product goal, that don't have a sprint goal, well, chances are that morale is lower. And and this, well, sprint goals matter for a lot of other reasons as well, but it's just one of the things that we've noticed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that quickest way to demotivate a team is to separate them from their customers and that purpose. Like, as soon as you do that, good luck, you know. It's hard for anybody to stay, you know, motivated and engaged. Nope. So have you had any feedback or thoughts on people in teams, like, maybe giving some pushback on the survey, like, why do I need to do this thing? And like not wanting to go through the survey. I can see Scrum Masters loving it and being like, yeah, this is going to be awesome. Like, I'm going to help make the things that I see, you know, visible to everybody else and we can all work on it together. But I could see team members maybe being a little resistant.
Yeah. And I can imagine that. And we've heard about this. One of the reasons is, for example, like what happens with my data. That's a very understandable concern. We don't do anything with it. We don't sell it. We don't share it with other people. So that's one thing I can say to that. But usually it's also just this idea of going somewhere and giving very clear answers to very clear questions. Mm-hmm. That can be painful if there's no safety yet in the team. So usually what we say is just have a conversation within your team about it first. Like, how do we feel about this? And then make the decision to do it together. I think that's always a much better start for this. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think, Barry? Because we've had this question before, of course, from teams.
Yeah, I don't have got a lot of feedback, like negative feedback, or that people are not willing to use the survey. I do recognize that Scrum Masters are very eager and excited to give it a try. That's not really surprising, but yeah, that's something what I like a lot. But more, I think some people did wonder, like, not really sure if they use those words, but is it going to be a judgmental survey? Is it going to be like naming and shaming, and that team members are going to be compared to each other, teams are going to be compared to each other, and when they see that that's not the case, it's like it's anonymous, you cannot really compare teams. Mm-hmm. Then, well, they are more willing to give it a try. And actually, I fully agree with them. If I would have been part of a Scrum team, then I also would not felt comfortable to try such a survey if I would have known that the names would be visible and that you could very easily compare me with other teams that might be in a completely different context, completely different situation. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense to compare teams with each other. What does make sense is to track trends over teams so that you can see, like, hey, given all the teams we have, ship it fast seems to be a problem. Or given all the teams we have, we need to focus more on delivering value to our stakeholders, something like that. I mean, that becomes possible, but not like on individual level that you can compare the teams.
And the thing about the survey is, like, each person's doing it. So what I consider to be a 7 out of 10 is going to be different than what Barry thinks is a 7 out of 10. So it's very similar to velocity. And I always tell teams, like, velocity, if you're going to use story points, should only ever be used by the Scrum team. We should never share that outside of the Scrum team. It's for our internal purposes. Same thing with a survey. Like, it's for your internal purposes. And then we're going to do some trending analysis. But, like, we're not going to know which teams are which. We're just looking for, is there a downward trend in a certain category over time because of some system change we made, or a positive trend because of some system change. That's what we should be looking for.
And you know, what's interesting is one thing we found is that, and I still don't know what it means. Maybe we can figure that out together, but we did get questions from Scrum Master that said the team thinks they're doing quite well. So their scores are quite high, but I don't think they're that good. So the question then is, are Scrum Masters right? Is it like the team is just too optimistic about their own ability, or are Scrum Masters too negative, cynical about the ability of their team? And what do teams compare themselves with? What do Scrum Masters compare themselves with? So I'm still not sure what this could mean.
I don't know. My opinion, I'll let Jeff jump in here. I don't think it matters. Like if you say like we're eights and nines on everything, but then you find one area where you're a 10, well, you're probably better at that area than the sevens and eights area. And so maybe that's an area to focus on, and maybe we're good on the 10 area. It doesn't matter if it's threes or fours and fives. And it's like, well, then let's say we're probably better on the fives. Let's focus on the threes, you know? Mm-hmm. So the scale doesn't matter as much because everyone's going to think about it differently. So I guess I wouldn't worry too much about that if I was going to give advice to the Scrum Master. And it's like, look where the differences are, and let's focus on the lower things because they are lower for a reason. So let's ask that question to the team.
But I think if teams learn over time that this is actually a tool that is beneficial for them, not for the environment of the team, then they might also start giving them the ratings that might be more close to, well, reality. Well, because it's not in their benefit as well. If they only give very high scores, then what are they going to learn? But then again, they might have a background with surveys or maturity models that were mostly for the outer world, for the supporting organization. And then, well, it might be better if you give yourself higher ratings.
Mm-hmm. I was as throughout this entire conversation, I've been doing a whole lot of introspective and thinking, and it kind of came up, Christian, in the question that you were just asking here earlier. I feel like the life of a consultant is always, to me, really enjoyable because you're constantly switching from client to client. You're never really getting entrenched in the politics of an organization. And it gives you the opportunity to come in with a fresh set of eyes and see oftentimes things that have just become commonplace for that organization. And why I say that is when you ask that question, like, oh, Scrum Masters, they're rating the teams lower than the teams think. Like, it's certainly an it depends type question, but sometimes that fresh set of eyes coming in from the outside, things become immediately visible to them that the people internal to that aren't seeing. And I have the good fortune of working with Jordan Job, another PST in the community, and he likes using the analogy. I think he got it from Flawless Consulting or some consulting book, like the cucumber doesn't realize it's turned into a pickle. They call it the pickle factor, right? And so he'll often, because I'm a little bit newer to the organization, he'll come in and be like, have I just been pickled? Like, is this... should I be worried about this thing, or is it, you know, just the way that we do things around here? And having that fresh outside perspective is really useful. And I apologize for a little bit of this rant, but this is why I love doing the podcast, because it gives me selfishly an opportunity to learn from really smart people and ask myself, am I being pickled, right? Am I looking at the right things here based off of this great conversation that I'm hearing from other people? And everybody's time is a fixed resource, shall we say. Like, everybody gets 24 hours in a day. Where is the biggest bang for buck with the time that you are spending with things? Is it properly defining out your product and the next goal that you want to be going after? Is it making sure that we're executing and able to deliver every 2 weeks or whatever our iteration happens to be? Is it going after and tackling those impediments to psychological safety in our work environment, right? Like, you hit on five key things here a little bit ago, but pick your battle and go after the one that you think is going to provide the most value to you. Mm-hmm. So I'll end my rant with that because I love the opportunity to sit down and talk with really smart people. So Christian, Barry, Jeff, thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Well, thank you too, because it's the same for us, I think, right? So Yeah, but the question is, have you already discovered where you're pickled?
I feel like it's all over the place. For me, outside in perspective, I think it's the whip. Like everybody in every, like, this isn't a feather in a cap by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, I started work at roughly 10 a.m. in the morning and I didn't finish until 11 o'clock last night. And to me, that's not a badge of courage. There's too much stuff on my plate, right? There shouldn't be a need to consistently put in that amount of time at an organization or for anything. Certainly I love what I do, but also like, I've got a wife and a family and, you know, all that other stuff that's mixed in there. So to me, I think where I'm pickled is I've accepted an unacceptable level of work that is put on my plate.
And I think that's a common problem that a lot of people have, especially going to remote work. And I don't know, Barry Christian, I'll ask you, what have you seen? Is it different in the Netherlands than it is here? And how have you dealt with that when you're working with teams, people working unsustainably?
You mean during working from home?
Especially working from home. I think it's only got exponentially worse working from home because it's hard for people to put boundaries in place. I don't know. Do you have thoughts on what you've tried personally or what you've worked with teams on?
I'll let Barry talk about my boundaries.
No, but something that I have noticed is that I think Chris and I have a luxury that, well, it's just a two-person company and we're quite strict in things that we schedule, like calls, these podcast episodes, etc. So we have maybe, speaking for myself, I've got maybe one or two calls a day max. And I've been involved in a couple of teams and they really have back-to-back Zoom or Team or Google Hangout calls the entire day. And they can just, well, do the real work in the evening or in the weekends. But then again, when I asked them, like, but what was it like for you before Corona? It was like similar, but then it's just like in the office meetings all day long. So for them, it did not change that much. However, these virtual or online calls proved to be more intense for them as well. Of course, these were just like, there are also plenty of teams that find a good balance and more healthy balance. And just to be clear about that as well, but some of the teams, like with working from home, it doesn't just magically solve all the problems that are going on in an organization.
I know it's hard to tell. It's hard to say if people are working more from home. If they were working more from home during the pandemic, also in the evenings, because, for example, the people that I know that they were able to sort of stop work at 5 o'clock, which is in the Netherlands sort of a regular time to stop work. But personally, Barry and I have been putting in way more hours than what's actually healthy, I think. But it's also because, like, there is sort of a crisis, so you're trying to sort of turn the ship around. So you have to put in, this is sort of team morale, right? Maybe we're both not very happy with it, but we were like, yeah, we're gonna do this thing. And I think that a lot of people have been feeling that since the start of the pandemic, because, well, a lot of companies were in crisis, so people are still responsible.
Just this weekend, sorry, Chris, to interrupt you, but just this weekend, like a relative of me asked me, like, so, Barry, when are you going to go back to work? Because you're already at home, like, for more than a year. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Speaking of, did you notice any trends that were also maybe reflected in the survey over the course of the pandemic?
I haven't analyzed the data yet specifically during the COVID pandemic, but one thing that I thought was very interesting was that, well, team morale went down for teams, not a lot, but it went down, and stakeholder collaboration went down. What was interesting is that Daniel Russo, who I wrote the paper with, he actually did research into developers and how they were dealing with COVID and working from home. And what he has shown in his study is he measured developers in two moments in time, and then he compared their productivity level. And actually, he was able to show that productivity did not decline during the pandemic. It actually went up a little bit. So it's interesting. The patterns are not very clear. I don't know if the people that were more productive put in more hours, for example. I don't think he measured that. But we did see some patterns, but I have to dig deeper into what they actually mean and how stable they are.
One other quick question here about the data. I'm kind of curious, do you ask any questions about scaling, as if that's a part of your environment? And if so, are there any trends for scaled versus non-scaled environments for teams? Mm.
There's not yet a question about scaling, but we want to add that this or next week, and a couple more questions about diversity in teams, because we think, well, we know from scientific research that diversity, for example, matters. I have a big hunch that scaling also matters. So we kind of want to test that with data. What I can already say is that the size of the organization has no influence whatsoever on the results. So very large organizations have successful Scrum teams and very small organizations have it. Also, the age of teams doesn't matter. The size of teams doesn't matter. So that already gives you sort of an indirect way to because I think a lot of large organizations use scaling one way or another. What would you expect?
I would expect that scaling environments probably, and this is all just guesswork, right?
But like, go ahead.
That a scaled environment probably has less connection with a customer and less overall direction and control over the product direction.
And therefore that demotivates people because they don't feel like they make as big a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That'd be my hypothesis.
Yeah, maybe they can't release as frequently because they have release trains that are very long. So it's nice. We're generating hypotheses that we can test here. So that's great.
Yeah. I mean, if you think of like mental models, like your last podcast when you were talking about that, like, I guess my mental model is that people probably don't make things explicit, maybe on like what clean code looks like. And so then they get frustrated when they have to go in and clean up another team's code. And instead of like talking about that and making things explicit, maybe that just gets swept on the rug because it's the next thing we've got to work on. Mm. And then that leads the team, teams being unhappy or just frustrated because it's like, I'm always cleaning up, you know, Christian's team, you know, stuff. They never do this right. And that just gets to people over time.
Yeah, that's a really good one. Well, the idea that we have for the coming, well, it's going to be years probably, but the idea is that we're going to ask all these questions like diversity, scaling, other things that we think are important. And we're going to track a lot of teams over time to see how changes in those things actually impact results. So for example, if organizations adopt a scaling framework, how does that impact the scores? If the teams become more or less diverse, how does that impact scores? If we know what those effects are, we can actually give organizations more specific recommendations on how to support Scrum teams. And ultimately that's what it's all about. And this is going to be very evidence-based. Just will take a long time to get that much data. So I hope all the listeners will fill in the free survey because that's sort of feeding all this research. More coming soon.
And that's the advantage that we all get by being a part of this and building it out as a community, is that we get to now look at the data as an aggregate and look for trends. And instead of just feeling something so one way or another, we actually have data to support it. Exactly. And I think that'll be a really huge benefit to the community. This has been awesome, guys. Is there anything, kind of as we're wrapping this up, that the two of you want to plug to our listeners?
Barry first?
Well, nothing comes to mind yet. So if you already have something in mind, Chris, then be my guest.
So I would gladly invite all listeners to just try out the Scrum Team Survey if you've never used it before. We're changing it all the time. So if you've done it like 2 years ago when we launched it, just do it again because there are a lot of different things in there. Like I said, the core features are free, which the most important stuff is free. You can always subscribe to get some more things. But most importantly, just help us gather this data because the research we're doing is very helpful. And I think Barry, maybe the patron community, because they're supporting this too. Maybe that's a good one to mention, right?
Yeah, that one was so obvious that I didn't think about it. No, yeah, like Chris mentioned, like the survey is for the largest part free, so that you can use. But and Chris and I spent a lot of our time in expanding the survey, time that we could also have spent on well-paid consulting, something like that. It's just a choice, of course. But to get some funding, we started a patron community, and patrons are people that become a member of a community that give a small financial monthly donation. And with these donations, we have the financial space to build new features. It's actually as simple as that. And the advantage of being a patron is that you'll be the first to know about when a new feature is going to be released. And also you get content. We have the habit of writing blog posts and creating also podcast episodes. You'll be the first to receive those ones as well. So it's a win-win. It's very beneficial to join our patron community. So just go to patreon.com/liberators.
Thank you for listening to the Agile Wire. We are consistently inspecting and adapting ourselves. We would appreciate feedback at feedback@theagilewire.com or on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play Store. See you next time.